I wonder whether China thinks the same about Taiwan, though. You know, would there really be a retaliation?
It'd be a hell of a move to. They're basically saying, okay, America, do you want to go full blown?
You know, and to bring it back to chips, you know, why would America come to Taiwan's aid? You know, aside from the fact that there's a pact and there's an agreement.
Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. I thought the weather was nice this week, but I took the dog out for a walk yesterday and I got pissed on the entire time. Poor dog's just been groomed as well. So it came back, it was just this shivering rat.
It's always a bit
sorry for it. I had a raincoat on, it didn't. There we are. We're 1 week closer to maybe being able to do one in person. We keep getting people wanting to get on the pod, don't we?
We do. I don't know. Are we actually allowed to go into the office, though, on the...
Well,
we
I don't know. I'm wondering when we should ask. It's the 12th is when there's the official government going, all right, then, you know, you can have some mates again.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see what the office is. I mean, if they won't let us in, then that's going to be a bit of a waste of time, isn't it?
So, yes, yeah. We could always sit up by the river and do one outdoors, but Pierre might
start
setting all that up. That. So I'm probably get arrested anyway.
While necking a bottle of bourbon. We could have a bit where we... Do you remember when we did that one at, in King's Cross, there was the Omdia event and we tried to do it outside and some Jobsworth moved us along.
That's right. This was even before coronavirus.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
That's what it'd be like now.
We'll probably get busted. So, yes, so that's that. What are we going to chat about this week? Hasn't been the busiest week for news, it's got to be said. No. But I thought we'd start. You wrote an excellent analytical piece looking at the kind of the state of the global semiconductor industry and what this means for telecoms, but also what it means for general geopolitics and all that sort of thing. You took a fairly standard Ian Morris bleak conclusion from it all, but that's all good fun. I'll be the chirpy one. I'll be the sort of Eric Idle of this one. Massive grumble. So yes, that's that, and that will lead on to 6G. It's a bit of a geopolitical special, not the first one we've done, but you know, we're lucky in that we happen to have found ourselves in an industry which is slap in the middle of a lot of bigger global strategic considerations right now. So
yeah, I mean, we're basically where oil and tech was, aren't we, 10 years ago, 20 years ago maybe.
Yeah, something like that.
That's how telecoms become now.
Fighting over telecoms. I don't think we're probably not even going to mention like Open RAN, but you know, there's another manifestation of it. But we are going to mention 6G because you know, everyone's just fixated on being the leader at 6G, which kind of defeats the whole point of global telecom standards.
Yeah,
there we are. Try telling politicians that. So we'll talk a bit about 6G. And then to finish off, we're going to talk about social media, but again, from a political point of view. Every so often, American politicians, both senators and representatives, like to get people like Mark Zuckerberg. I've forgotten the name of the lad in charge of Google these days. American Asian guy. Anyway.
Yes, I know who you mean, but I can't remember either.
And Jack Dorsey. See, I'm so racist. I remember the two white people, but not the Asian guy.
He of the long beard.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up now. That's a poor effort. Anyway, they like to get them together, these sort of Silicon Valley execs, and just basically tell them off. There he is. What's his name? I'm going to have to get back to you. I keep wanting to say Rajiv Suri, but of course that's not.
So you chat a bit about things, and I'll look it up.
There we are. I found it. Sundar Pichai. Pichai, probably. Okay. Oh, hello. Look, and now I've got one of those sites where it auto played some. This is CNN Business.
So, something dodgy popped up.
Yeah, I've done a tubing. No, that was just CNN Business. So they like to bollock them over things like letting bad things happen on the internet, basically. And so, yes, we'll have a little look at that. And there's one or two other geopolitical things that we can talk about. Well, actually more things in that area, like Section 230, which is the sort of regulatory side of online censorship. So, yes, okay, that's enough waffling. I must make my intros a bit more concise. I mention something and then just start going off on one.
A bit of waffles, okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the format, isn't it?
It is.
So, yes. Oh, and just to remind you, for the last 2 weeks, I've forgotten to remind you where else you can get hold of this. So now I won't get in trouble. Pierre was going to sack me and replace me with a bot if I got it wrong. So if you're watching this on the website, you can also see it on Facebook and YouTube, and you can listen to it on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, and loads of other podcasting platforms. Right. Well, I think I'll probably hand the ball straight to you, as you've done, as is normally the case, the more substantial written work than I on this matter. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your piece regarding chips, the global chip industry, yeah, and why we should care?
Yeah, I mean, it got into chips more heavily than I originally intended, I suppose. I mean, I'd started off looking into Huawei a little bit, and the US sanctions, which aren't new, obviously. They've been in place for a while now, but they've been tightened up in, you know, the last months of, you know, Trump's presidency. And, you know, when it all happened originally, people were speculating about how long, you know, how badly this would affect Huawei, I guess, these sanctions, and how long it had before it, because the key thing is they're sort of closing it off from key components, you know, how long it would have before it ran out, or whether it could find alternatives. And
yes, this could affect so much. Like, yeah, as we've said loads of times on the pod, not just their mobile phone arm, which is very compromised right now, but its networking side as well.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the interest for me, because I think the mobile phone pressure has already been apparent. I mean, they've sort of owned up to that. They've kind of said, yeah, well, shipments are down because we can't get, you know, semiconductors.
And they've already spun off Honor.
Data. They've spun off Honor. They've, you know, and then third-party data firms that know what they're doing with that sort of thing, like Counterpoint Research. And does Strategy Analytics do any of that? Probably. Tracking shipments, what? You know, phone shipments.
Yeah, that's what thing? I used to do when I was there.
That's what you used to do,
much.
Isn't it? Yeah. There you are. So people
who market leaders obviously all fell off a cliff after I left. No offense, Neil. I bet Neil, my old boss, never listens to this. But no, they still very much do all that. Right. And Counterpoint, I don't know if you know, but Counterpoint was started up by a former colleague of mine at Strategy Analytics.
I didn't know that. Right.
And then another former colleague of mine went off and joined it. So it was all a bit... It's all a bit tasty, you know. People in the Strategy Analytics go, like, "I've seen what those fuckers are doing," I would basically sort of three of the people who are like the world leaders for tracking smartphones are former colleagues of mine.
Oh, okay,
there we are. Look at me.
So they kind of know what they're doing, but
you'd like to think.
Yeah, I mean, there's good data that they get, and they'd already sort of, I think, pointed to, you know, those firms had already pointed to quite a big drop off in shipments for Huawei last year. So that's already been apparent, but they've been quite quiet, a bit coy really about the network side of things. And, you know, then we get the message that revenues and profits are going to rise. They haven't reported yet for the full year 2020, but there have been some reports about growth, and they've been, so their founder's been saying that, you know, we're bigger than we were in 2019. So you sort of think, well, you know, if smartphones haven't done so well, then they've obviously made this up on the network side. And I think people are a bit, maybe people who saw all these sanctions and wondered what impact they would have are maybe a bit confused. And, you know, there's two things. One is obviously the fact there's been a huge amount of work going on in China on 5G rollout, and they've used a lot of the existing stock, I think, that they had to do that. And I think, you know, we talked about this before, but you haven't seen as much pushback in some other parts of the world as perhaps some people, including myself, were expecting, you know, when the US started to go after them. But it's apparent from talking to quite a lot of semiconductor experts previously, and then in the last few weeks, you know, including some equity analysts and people on background, and, you know, it's they're all pretty, you know, they're all sort of in agreement that they are in a really bad situation on the network side as well because of these sanctions. And essentially a lot of it comes back to this one company, which is TSMC, is a massive, yeah, Taiwanese foundry. that and supplies
and even more importantly than their size, they're the best at the cutting edge processes.
Yeah, so they're big and they're just extremely capable. And it had emerged when you know the sanctions first started to be announced that Huawei was a big. I mean, companies are often quite secretive about their suppliers, but it came out that they were a big supplier to Huawei. What it essentially does is it designs a lot of its own components in-house at a unit called HiSilicon, but then TSMC will do the. It's not a foundry; it doesn't have a fab itself. No. Huawei.
Hardly anyone does.
Yeah. So all the manufacturing is sort of done at these 11 foundries in Taiwan, and once you the way the Americans sort of shut it down was by. The sanctions stop companies from shipping to Huawei if they use any kind of American technology or expertise in their in their production process. Yeah, and one of the, I mean, there's various reasons why that would affect TSMC, but one of the big ones is that the chip making equipment that it uses, for instance, comes from companies like Applied Materials and Lam Research. In fact, most of the companies that make that stuff are American. I think there's a Dutch rival called ASML, but most of the actual chip making gear itself is US. So these sanctions have affected TSMC, and it's not tried to battle it. It's pretty much said we're going to stop shipping to Huawei, and it's left Huawei in a fix because those chips are just as important on the network side as they are on the smartphone side. I did a lot of digging into this to find out whether, you know, the key thing with TSMC is you just said it's really, really advanced. So the thing people want with semiconductors is, I mean, the way it's measured is in the size of the transistor, basically, these days. The smaller the transistor, the more of them you can kind of cram into a chip, and the more sophisticated, I mean, it's an oversimplification, but the more sophisticated the chip is. And you're now at the stage where they're talking about things as small as 5 nanometers, I think Apple's latest iPhones using chips that have that sort of transistor size, which is a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So it's, you know, it's ridiculously small. I think an atom's only 1 nanometer, isn't it, or something. So
you get into all sorts of weird things like electron leakage and stuff just literally slipping between atoms.
Yeah, and these really small, this 7 nanometer process is actually really important for some of the network products that Huawei makes. So a lot of the stuff that
hold on to that thought, because 7 nanometer specifically is relevant to Intel, which we could talk about in a bit as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was something I was unclear on, is how, you know, that sort of silicon geometry process, you know, how good that needs to be for stuff that you're supplying that's 5G equipment. And it's really critical, apparently. I mean, a lot of the analog componentry that goes into 5G gear, you can actually rely on, you know, 20 or 28 nanometer products. But for anything that's digital, you know, things like the digital front end, they call it, which are all things that go into radio units, that you basically need this 7 nanometer process to produce the most competitive equipment. So once you've blocked that off, then, you know, Huawei's left with, where do we get these 7 nanometer products from if we can't get them from TSMC? Yeah. And the trouble is, there's hardly anybody else that does it. In fact, I think there's only Samsung that still has that currently has that capability other than TSMC.
Mentioned South Korea is not known for its fondness for China either.
Well, Samsung would be in the same situation, I think, as TSMC. I mean, that the general feeling is that they also have American expertise and equipment in their processes. So they're subject to the same sanctions, and they're not a company that would ever want to upset the Americans, because they're very heavily reliant on US business, you know, and it's just, it's even less conceivable, I think, than TSMC trying to fight those sanctions. So the trouble for Huawei is, where can it go? It doesn't really have an alternative. And, you know, all it can really try to do is to develop this kind of capability itself within China. I mean, it wouldn't be something, I don't think, that Huawei would do, but certainly the Chinese government thinking at the moment.
Yeah, well, talking about Chinese government, didn't I read this week that there's a bunch of money being thrown at a foundry.
Well, the main Chinese foundry,
Shenzhen.
Yes, possibly, and that's something.
But that's not going to be 7 nanometer. That's the thing. That's going to be like a much larger process. So, I mean, but it's the first step of China trying to be autonomous when it comes to chips.
Yeah, and that this is certainly going to be a project now that's that ever since those US sanctions, and actually probably before those US sanctions were announced, I think that, that it would have been part of China's plan to have more sort of chip autonomy. And, you know, the options are, the only alternative really for Huawei is a company called SMIC, which is a Chinese foundry. Now, again, I think even they're reliant on US expertise and equipment, and maybe they would not pay attention to the sanctions and try and carry on using what they've got and except they're going to be cut off from future supplies, but carry on trying to supply Huawei. But the problem is they don't have, I think they're currently at about 14 nanometer. And, you know, if you look at experts who cover these companies, they're becoming more capable and they're certainly closing the gap. But nobody that I spoke to is very optimistic that China will be able to, you know, be as good as TSMC or have that foundry capability in a short period of time. I mean, it's not something they're going to do even in the next one or 2 years. You're talking about a sort of 5-year project from experts I spoke
with. The latest Kirin chipset, which is of the Hisense, the Huawei own brand semiconductor thing, was 5 nanometer, according to something I'm reading from October 2020.
Well, the only one that's at 5 nanometer is TSMC. I think they have 5 nanometer now.
That's just the Kirin 990 was 7 nanometer, but again, and it says this is an article from Phone Arena. Look at me, I'm actually getting better at doing a bit of Googling while we're talking. Article from Phone Arena, not that I had far to climb from. Said SMIC is closing in on 7 nanometer process. So that's something. But we both wrote about times where even SMIC was constrained by this American.
They're constrained, and I don't think they're closing in that fast from people that I've spoken to. I think they're on about 14 at the moment. And as you say, to get the equipment is a challenge for them as well, because they've also been reliant on US chip making equipment. Now apparently they tried to buy something from this Dutch company, ASML, back in 2019. But the Dutch government blocked the sale.
Yeah.
And I think now they might just have thought, we don't want to upset anybody and it's not a good deal.
We can't have our chips.
But the other thing is, it's not only the chip making equipment, you have this software involved in the process called electronic design automation, which is all to do with sort of laying out the circuitry. And there's only the top three companies that do that. And this is, I've got this from Huawei themselves, Cadence, Synopsys and Mental Graphics, I think they are. And they're all US based. So it's the same issue. You can't use the tool.
And then you've got ARM as well. I mean, ARM doesn't just license out designs for cores like CPUs and that sort of thing, but ARM does a hell of a lot of the clever stuff to do with what they call packaging. In other words, the rest of the cleverness that has to house that core, and make it work and make this system on chip. So yes, I mean, the long and short of it is the Americans are in a position to turn off the tap on a hell of a lot of high tech if they want to. And there's every sign, as we've discussed before on the pod, that the Biden administration fully intends to continue with that policy.
Yeah. Now, the reason it's a worry, not only, I think, for Huawei, but for other people as well. So Huawei's situation, from my understanding at the moment, is, you know, they probably will run out. They probably will start to show some pressure this year that they didn't last year on the network side as well. So we've seen this drop off in shipments. But, you know, it will be very surprising if we don't see something happening on the network side, I think, this year. Now, they might have been able to stockpile and manage for a bit longer than analysts were expecting. But They just don't have a short-term alternative in terms of actually finding an alternative supplier and building their own. So it all raises questions about, this is where the geopolitics gets interesting, because Taiwan's obviously a bit of a flashpoint anyway.
Yeah.
It's according to the Chinese Communist Party, it's actually part of China anyway, isn't it? And they've long had territorial claims on it.
Which is why people like WHO shit themselves when they get asked specific questions, because apparently you're not even allowed to talk about Taiwan.
Yeah, and so
you mention it. It's just China.
You can't talk about it. And so you, all of a sudden you start thinking, and this was mentioned to me by a couple of people, that this is a kind of scenario. It's a bit of a doomsday scenario, but it's sort of another reason for. I don't think they would invade Taiwan simply because of the Huawei chip supply issue. But it sort of gives them another reason to do that. It would deal with that issue. It would also be because TSMC is so important, not just to Huawei, but to anybody that relies on 7-nanometer technology, which is likely to include just people,
basically the whole world.
From our sector specifically, I mean, yeah, it's much broader than telecom. But if we're talking about telecom specifically, these companies won't tell me who their suppliers are. But it's very likely that Ericsson and Nokia also use TSMC, given that they're also trying to make very, very capable 5G network equipment. And given that they don't, there's only two companies that do 7-nanometer, Samsung and TSMC. Yeah. So if you get this situation where China was to do something as dramatic as that and actually invade Taiwan, all of a sudden TSMC's ability to supply those Nordic companies is called into question, isn't it? And I think this is one of the reasons why it's much broader than telecom, obviously, but this is why we're seeing so much interest all of a sudden. And you're going to start talking about Intel now in
I'm waiting my turn.
That was my segue.
But you're inviting me. Oh, okay.
And
I thought you were just going, just like a gobshite you are. You're just going to steam in with your stuff. I was just looking at your story, actually, and how you've got pictures of warships and stuff, because one thing I was going to say,
you've got to have a picture of a warship.
You've got to have a picture of a warship.
I mean, it's better than a base
station with a big Chinese flag on it. Yes, I mean, I was just going to say, without in any way diminishing the impact of what you said, China invades Taiwan, not being able to get hold of 7-nanometer chips can be the least of our fucking problems.
I did say that in the story that
that's why I was reminding myself that
trying to take control of those facilities is the thing we've got to think about China invading Taiwan is whether the assumption has always been China invades Taiwan and the US comes to Taiwan's defense, hasn't it? But I wonder whether some of these geopolitical alliances, NATO and promises to South Korea and all sorts of other promises that the Americans have made in the past about, you know, a lot of that seemed to become less relevant during the Trump era, didn't it? No one was very convinced that if Russia invades Estonia or something, that Trump would actually do anything about it, or that NATO would do much about it. I mean, they've already waded into Georgia and Ukraine, haven't they, in recent years? And the Western response has been pretty much zero. So I just wonder whether China's invasion of Taiwan would actually result in US military action in retaliation. I'm not convinced it would.
I think they'd have to. You know, it's a bit like other sort of super conflicts where you get this sort of domino effect. You know, if you look at how the British behaved in the 20th century, we tended to act like in the First World War, you know, we had a pact with Belgium and we honoured it. In the Second World War, this is a complete tangent, but I've been reading some stuff. You know, we've had all this silliness to do with the vaccines in Europe, and the French, forgive me for this, Pierre, have been among the most petulant politically. And there's there was one person was saying that culturally the French will never forgive us for not surrendering in the Second World War, because the Germans had every reason to believe we would. We were pretty fucking dysfunctional. I don't think, you know, our armed forces were any great shakes. We could have just pulled up the drawbridge across the English Channel and gone, over to you guys. We've had enough of this bullshit. You know, we killed our country like 20 years ago, and now you're kicking off again. You having a laugh, but we didn't, and we sort of kept the good fight going until places like the US got their shit together. Anyway, the reason I went off on that tangent is these sort of pacts, and the US presumably has a pact with Taiwan.
But there's supposed to be a NATO pact to come to the defence of members.
Yeah, NATO's irrelevant. NATO might as well not exist anymore. This is just about the US. NATO, look, Europe, we know that the full military capacity of continental Europe consists of one bloke in a Jeep with a German Shepherd. So, you know, they could just forget it. You know, that's why the Russians feel completely free to pile into Crimea every now and then. They're just going, what are you going to do?
Yeah, but
the European Union would have to have 10 meetings before they could even decide which
which end of a gun to hold.
But I wonder whether China thinks the same about Taiwan, though. You know, would there really be a retaliation?
Be a hell of a move to. They're basically saying, okay, America, do you want to go full blown?
You know, and to bring it back to chips, you know, why would America come to Taiwan's aid? You know, aside from the fact that there's a pact and there's an agreement, actually one reason to do it would be to protect chips. Yes. That's the only thing that you get from Taiwan is chips. Really.
So now,
if they're going to find solutions to that, like the Intel plan.
Quite, yeah. So I'll accept your invitation there. That was a story I wrote this week. Which is that Intel. So Intel's been having a little nightmare. The main reason they've been having a nightmare is because of the 7-nanometer process. Now, I'm going to defer. There's been some great analysis of all this, not done by me. One of them is by a chap who runs a very well-known website called Stratechery, spelled Stratech areas in a portmanteau of strategy and tech. He's called Ben Thompson, I think, something like that.
I know Ben Thompson, yeah.
Yeah. He obviously knows
his
shit.
He's pretty well known.
And he did an analysis of it. And anyway, and what's happened is Intel got a former exec of theirs who went off to be CEO of VMware called Pat Gelsinger. And they've had a turnover of a few CEOs recently. It's not going well. You got Gelsinger in, and as I think we chatted about last week with Nokia, when you get a new CEO in, that's a great time to just have a clean sweep and just go, right, okay, we'll draw a line under all that bullshit. This is where we're going now. And this seems to be what Gelsinger has done. He did a great big sort of Zoom presentation. And one of the things, and people like Stratechery are very complimentary of him, going, that is how to do a fucking CEO presentation. And one of the things he got credit for was to admit what went wrong. And so Intel, yeah, we don't talk about Intel that much because they've always been shite at anything to do with mobile. God knows they've tried, but they've always failed. But one of the main reasons they failed is they've got their own microarchitecture, which is generally called x86. And it's good at certain things, but in low power, space-constrained, heat-constrained environments, ARM microarchitecture is much better, which is why ARM is ubiquitous in mobile and Intel's nowhere. But they're still huge in PCs. They're still huge in data centers. They're still a huge chip company, but they're unique in so much as they don't just design their own chips, they manufacture their own chips. So they're this whole closed shop. You know, they've got the full Monty, whereas people like Qualcomm, Huawei or whatever, design the chips and then get TSMC to manufacture them. And then conversely, foundries just do the manufacturing, but none of the designing. Intel is unique. Well, it's not unique. The only other company that does this to some extent is Samsung, in that it designs and makes its own chips.
Not at 7-nanometer ones, though.
Not at 7-nanometer. So I'm actually going to...
They're done by TSMC.
Well, no. Not until... No,
Intel outsources its 7-nanometer production to TSMC.
Well, it's about to, but it has never previously. It's never outsourced. So I'm going to read a passage...
But that's in the plan, yeah.
That's in the plan, yeah. So I'm going to read a passage that explains it better than I could by this lad Thompson on Stratechery. This is quoting... Here was the problem. Over the last decade, ASML, who you've referred to previously, and ASML alone had perfected extreme ultraviolet lithography, EUV.
That's it, yeah, yeah.
Which is essential for making the most advanced chips. But Intel, instead of committing to ASML's technology, tried to go its own way with its own technology and preferred supplier, brackets Nikon, using immersion lithography. So basically, they made, a bit like a Nokia situation, they made a strategic decision not to go with what seemed to be the market-leading technology, this EUV. And I went, no, fuck it, we're going to do our own. And you can imagine, you know, when your whole corporate culture is we do things our own way, we don't outsource, we don't, you know, we try and do as much in-house as possible. You can see why they might make these bad decisions. Anyway, he goes on to say, after a few years of delays, the company finally got 10-nanometer working, barely. But instead of realizing it hit the wall with immersion lithography, i.e., there are certain physical walls. You know, you just can't build things that small without certain technologies. Intel believed it could apply its 10-nanometer learnings to 7-nanometer, which had been developed in parallel. It couldn't. So Gelsinger's gone, yeah, all right, we fucked up. So now we're going to get ASML on board, do extreme ultraviolet, or what was it called, extreme? Yeah.
Extreme ultraviolet lithography.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And that's where we're going to go. So he's drawing a line under it. But in order to make that work, they've got to do two things. And I'll get to the geopolitical side in a sec. We've got to do two things. Firstly, we've got to outsource, like you said. If we don't have, currently have the 7-nanometer process, but we need to make 7-nanometer chips, then we've got to swallow our pride and pay the likes of TSMC to do it for us, and presumably join the back of the queue. Yeah. You know, people like Qualcomm and Apple are going, hold on a second. Well,
they have shortage problems at the moment as well.
Yes, exactly. So it's not an immediate fix, but it is a strategic fix. And then they said, and at the same time, we're going to also become a foundry as well. So they're not only getting other people to make Intel chips, they're going to get Intel factories to make other people's chips.
Yeah, which is a canny move given everything that's going on, because...
And that's where it plays into the geopolitical side of it. So, you know, in the actual press release, in fact, I'll read what Gelsinger said. He said, quote, "We're excited to be partnering with the state of Arizona and the Biden administration on incentives that spur this type of domestic investment." Straight up front, the first thing he said is that we're doing this because the US government is chucking money at us.
Right.
So, you know, that's not even me reading between the lines. That's his quote. You know, excited to be partnering with Biden and talking about incentives.
And I'd speculated in my story on Huawei and TSMC that they were, you know, there was US sort of pressure on them to do that Arizona plan, but it, you know, it's not
pressure and so stick and carrot.
Just came out and said it. Yeah.
Yeah, stick and carrot.
Completely.
And I bet that carrot is a pretty fucking meaty one as well.
Yeah. So, as an aside on the 10-nanometer stuff, because I spoke with, and this shows how important these, you know, these really sophisticated processes are to big companies, and, you know, how dependent they are on just a few suppliers. I spoke with Nokia's head of mobile this week, Tommy Uito, about some of the problems they encountered. Now, we all know, we've talked about this a lot, that Nokia kind of, you know, sort of slipped up badly in 5G, you know, made some decisions a few years ago that have really badly affected its competitiveness, and it's trying to recover from that now. And this recovery is basically consume the attention of the new CEO. That's what they're, that's what his job is really.
It's the main
and
thing.
A lot of this comes back to what happened with Intel, because they'd originally contracted to have system on a chip stuff coming from Intel, you know, for their network equipment, based on, you know, high end processes based on 10 nanometer, I think. And they were kind of let down because Intel ran into problems.
So that's another reminder of how incredibly interconnected everything is.
Yeah, they were let down. And this is what forced them to go and use field programmable gate arrays, these you know...
I saw that in your write-up. I found that you said that forced them. I mean, is it as black and white as that?
There were several reasons why they used FPGAs, but one of the big ones, according to Tommy Wheaton, he's a man who should know. I mean, he's in head of mobile.
Course. I'm calling him a liar. I'm just wondering whether I understood it correctly.
We were let down by so they basically contracted a supplier, they say, but all analysts have identified it as Intel. So,
right.
You know, and I've named it as Intel.
And Intel was going to make ASICs, not FPGAs, yeah?
Yeah, Intel was doing ASIC system on a chip, not FPGA. It was was customized stuff that they were working on with Nokia. I mean, what they've done, that his strategy, his sort of answer to this, Tommy Wito's answer is several things. Now that they're trying to get rid of these FPGAs, they're resorted to, which is sort of like a fix, but also they did it because they. You know, they thought there would be some, they weren't quite sure about the direction of the standard, and he says they kind of got that wrong. There was a chance, if you remember a few years ago, when people thought
standalone
might come out first.
So the
programmability would have given them a bit of flexibility. And I think also they just underinvested on their own side. So they, and partly that was to do with the distraction of the Alcatel-Lucent merger. Yes. But they, I mean, we've seen this before.
So they made some bad bets and also... Yeah.
Because the SoC stuff is like what's apparent from talking to him is that he says the only company that actually develops it, the only mobile vendor, equipment vendor that develops or designs rather everything in house and then gets TSMC to make it is Huawei. What Nokia does, and by implication Ericsson, although Ericsson hasn't said this and they've not named who they work with, but he's implying that they do a similar thing, is they partner with companies like Intel, or Marvel or Broadcom. So those are the three companies now that Nokia is using. And the one of the problems they had is they had a single supplier strategy with Intel. So once Intel let them down, there was nowhere else for them to go quickly to sort this problem out. And what he's had to do is, you know, is to sort of spread the risk, is to make sure that in future they're not reliant on one particular partner. So whereas they just had Intel in the mix before, they've now introduced Broadcom and Marvell that are also, they're kind of doing slightly different things, but they're basically pooling their expertise with Nokia's, some of the stuff that it does, to produce a single system on a chip. So you've kind of got four parties involved in that process.
There was a Marvell Samsung story this week as well.
That's the same stuff, basically. Random chip. It's related to... So it proves that Samsung's the same. Samsung's basically working with... Whereas I think what Huawei does is all of that expertise comes from Huawei. You know, everything, all the stuff that Broadcom is doing with Nokia, that Marvell's doing with Samsung, that Intel's doing with Nokia and others. Huawei does pretty much everything through HiSilicon, and then TSMC makes it. But these other the other vendors in radio are much more reliant on US technology, actually, US technology chip designers for the stuff they produce. But the whole, I mean, to get back to the point, the whole sort of Intel 10 nanometer process problems basically completely tripped up. It wasn't just that, but it was a big reason why Nokia tripped up and went wrong, and why it's had to sort of try and fix that. And as I say, they haven't named Intel themselves, but it's apparent it is Intel that was the kind of...
Yeah, so there we are. So we've got the tale of two companies that are directly connected in the way you've just described, and also connected in terms of strategically rolling the dice and getting snake eyes.
Yeah.
So there you have it. So I think what's happened is Gelsinger has realised not only just something got to change anyway because they just kept fucking up, but this is actually the perfect time to say we're all in on the US, we're going to be a foundry. Because obviously what the Americans want from a strategic point of view is they want foundries on US soil.
Yeah.
Right now, the main foundry that companies like Qualcomm and Apple use is in Taiwan. It's right next door to China, thus very vulnerable to Chinese moodiness.
And the interesting thing about that is that Intel isn't the only company that's building a foundry in Arizona. TSMC is as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that one.
So they've invited to... So this is the whole thing. You know, this is why this whole China-Taiwan issue is so interesting. I mean, the Pentagon's done scenarios on this, you can tell. And a lot of this thinking comes from that. That a Chinese taker... we need... If you've got foundries on soil, on your soil, then it's, you don't have to worry as much, do you? But the prospect of these things being taken over by China... And all of a sudden, it jeopardizes your. It's like the stuff that we were talking about, or people were talking about, not us, 30 or 40 years ago in the oil industry, isn't it? You know, the kind of oil embargoes that were happening in the 1970s.
When everything was relied on Middle Eastern oil. But now it's chips. And
now it's chips. It's the other interesting angle to this is we haven't talked about Europe or the UK. So Europe is trying to boost its own production. So they're obviously worried about this as well. There's this 2030 plan they came out with in recent weeks. I think you covered it, or maybe Mary did for you, and we wrote about it as well, where the single standout thing in that plan, that document, was this proposal to try and boost chip production to 20%, I think, of the world's total. I was actually surprised they do 10% now, but clearly they don't do anything that's particularly deep submicron. It's all going to be, you know, less advanced stuff.
But Intel's got plants in Europe. There's the Global Foundries one I visited myself that I can confirm exists in Dresden.
Global Foundries is all 22 nanometer to 90 nanometer, from what I've understood.
Right. They gave up
trying to compete in that deep submicron game a few years ago.
I know, isn't that sad? They were, I mean, when it's part of AMD, you know, they were sort of more or less going toe-to-toe with Intel.
Yeah,
it just shows how tough this is, because they've chucked money at it. I mean, they've got a bunch of Middle East money in Global Foundries, like, you know, Abu Dhabi sovereign funds and shit like that going on.
They have, but they've I mean, that other stuff's useful. It's not like the, you know, if you only do stuff that's 22 nanometer to 90 nanometer, it's a waste of time. It's used in lots of things. They've just decided that for them that makes more business sense. But I guess the problem now I talked to somebody this week, sort of a bit on background, but he advises the government, the UK government, on chip strategy. And this is a massive issue, I think, for the UK at the moment as well. We've just come out of Europe. You've got everything that I've already talked about going on regarding Taiwan. you know, there must be an issue for the UK as well, chip security. I mean, maybe
yes.
the fact that Intel's setting up foundries and TSMC setting up foundries in Arizona, we're thinking, well, that's okay because it's a friendly partner, and as long as there's yeah. some supply in other parts of the world, it's okay. But I bet there's parts of the government that are thinking about how they approach this. And I think there was talk about Intel maybe doing a European plant. Is that right?
Well, and then there's the yes, that was part of the announcement.
Why not the UK? I mean, because anything that Europe has,
we need to
especially
get on
with
it.
All the stuff that's going on about with coronavirus at the moment,
vaccines, you know, and all that shit. Yeah, well,
we're not having a very good time with Europe, are we? So we don't really.
No, we're not. We're not in their good books. But you know, we're part of the reason they've got the arsehole with us is we're making a virtue of being independent and nimble, and they don't like what that's, you know, how that sort of shows up the more sort of super tanker like EU bureaucracy. But you know, resisting the temptation to just put the boot in yet again into Europe. You know, the UK. Yeah, this is our opportunity to do deals with people like Intel and all that sort of thing. Show the same kind of opportunism that we did with the vaccines. And it's quite clear that another reason Europe's got the arsehole with the vaccines, from what I've read, is that basically we, on the sly, did a deal with AstraZeneca that said we've got our first shout. And we chucked some money at them. We presumably chucked plenty of public money at this whole Oxford-AstraZeneca thing. And so that's why Europe's got the hump, because it's there in black and white that the UK's got to get vaccines before the rest of Europe does. It's in the contract. And so that's fine. I mean, it's probably not fair. It's probably not playing entirely by the rules of international cooperation and trade. But you know what? Everyone takes the piss. Europe will take the piss. Ask anyone who isn't France or Germany about how much piss gets taken in Europe. Ask the Greeks.
It's only an issue because it's a major health crisis, isn't it? That's the reason it's an issue. I mean,
yeah, but I'm saying that let's also tip the scales in our favour on things like chips. Let's bribe Intel completely. to build a goddamn foundry here.
This is the thing. The other thing I would say is one of the guys I spoke to, I did quote in my story, called Earl Lum, who works for he's basically a one man sort of analyst outlet, but very high profile. He used to work for a foundry himself years ago, and is regarded as is quoted in the Wall Street Journal from time to time. Really knows his stuff. I mean, one of the smartest guys I've spoken to about this stuff, and he was saying governments really underestimate how difficult it is to do this. You know, it's like the amount of money that Taiwan's put into TSMC over the years, you know, going back, is substantial. You're talking tens of billions of dollars to get these foundries up and going. And you also need, it's not just building the, you need a lot of land, you need a lot of cheap land, because they take up so much space.
Yes.
I mean, you've been in a foundry, haven't you, Scott? And it needs to be the right conditions to do that. And you need people.
And power and pure water.
So it's really hard to do. It's not an easy thing. And I think this whole European, you know, we're going to double to 20%. You just wonder whether they're underestimating how difficult it is to actually do what they're saying they're going to do.
Yeah. Okay. We better move it on, but only slightly, because, you know, talking about basically what the picture we're painting here is a broad narrative we've spoken about for a while, which is the sort of balkanization of the telecoms and tech sector. As soon as the Americans decided the best way to knock China down a peg or two was over trade and access to technology, they immediately made it imperative that the Chinese try and make themselves autonomous as possible. And so now everyone's trying to be autonomous. Everyone's trying to be autonomous in chip manufacturer and all that sort of thing. And I think they're also looking to be autonomous in the 6G standard. So, you know, we're at 5G right now. No one knows. No one's even that sure why they should care. But we do know that there's going to be a 6G. You know, that's as certain as death and taxes. And, you know, only in the 5G era, and only really in the Trump era and post, has telecoms become this matter of geopolitical strategic importance. You know, 3G, the Americans tried to do CDMA, but ended up being GSM, and that was fine. We all got over it. It was like one of those VHS Betamax type of things.
Yeah, and that was almost more of a business move, wasn't it, really? I think in those days, I think some of the geopolitics that gets linked to the, you know, to 5G wasn't apparent in 3G. It was never considered to be as strategic, I don't think.
Yeah, it's just people like Qualcomm wanting to own as much of the standard as possible.
all this stuff about chips being, you know, telecom being used in military systems and critical infrastructure wasn't a story with 3G at all. It was all about, you know, internet on your phone, and no one really knew what that would entail or whether it would work very well. So I don't think governments cared in the same way as they do now. And therefore, you know, that affects how companies that are involved in the space think about it as well, doesn't it?
Totally, totally. And that's just become even more so. Again, with 4G, even not so much then. I certainly don't remember writing about 4G in a geopolitical way very much.
No.
But now we do, and 6G even more. Basically, what happened was everyone shat themselves over 5G, didn't they? Thinking, hold on a sec. You know, let's not forget what we've been writing about every other story for the last couple of years. They're like, oh, my God, if there's Huawei gear in the 5G network, then Chinese will be able to spy on us and we're all going to die. Yeah. You know, we're still not totally convinced that the mere presence of any Huawei technology anywhere in the 5G network constitutes a geopolitical security risk. But we don't make the call. And the politicians, especially the American politicians, decide it does. And now it's got so much that with 6G, like the Americans are just going, well, look, we don't want to have this shit happening again. Let's just make sure we've got our own 6G. We've got a 6G with stars and stripes on it and a bald eagle and apple pie and stuff on it. Yeah. And of course, China's doing the same. So basically this week, and I'll talk about something I covered first, and then you can talk about your stuff. Yeah. No, just a quick one, actually, just today. Only saw it. I just turned it around very quickly just before sending the newsletter. But there's this thing called the Next G Alliance in the States, which in turn is part of an alliance called ATIS. That's Alliance for Telecommunications Industry Solutions. Anyway, they've set up this thing. Next G is obviously 6G. And their strategic aim is to just make US, well, they say North America, but obviously they mean US, the leader of 6G. Now, how do you become, yeah, achieve North American 6G leadership? That's the verbatim strategic aim.
This is the Next G thing.
Exactly. So they want North America 6G leadership. This week there was China. This wasn't an official thing, but this is in China Daily, which is basically the Communist Party, as far as I understand. They said China eyes 6G as next tech frontier. So basically both...
Well, they've been eyeing that for 2 years.
Yes, well, that's true. This isn't a sudden development. Yeah. But, you know, it's yet another bit of public, what I call chest beating. So basically, we've got both the superpower blocks making a big public show of being really crazy about 6G. And just one last thing I want to say about this Next G Alliance thing before I ask you what you think is I couldn't help noticing that. So they announced their senior leadership, and it's basically AT&T and Ericsson. And then they've also got Nokia involved, VMware, and that's about it. What they haven't got in terms of the leadership is any Verizon or T-Mobile. Right. So I thought that's a bit of a shit alliance. Apparently they're members. I think
they are Mike, in it though. Yeah.
Yeah. Mike wrote about that on your site.
But I think pretty much anybody in mobile in America is in that group.
Yes, but they're not on the leadership team. Whereas there's two AT&T people on the leadership team.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so I'm wondering how much of an alliance that is. But anyway, so that's one thing I've been noticing in terms of 6G in the geopolitical side of things. Is there anything else you've been spotting?
Yeah, I mean, one thing you didn't mention there was the other superpower, if we can call it a superpower, the European Union. Not really a superpower, right, but a wannabe superpower. They've got their Hexa-G, or Hexa-X, is it? Hexa something, anyway.
Right, Hexa meaning six.
It's basically the equivalent of Next G. And that's got Ericsson and Nokia involved in it, but it also has some of the big European telcos. So Orange is involved, Telefonica, right, TIM, and there's actually some, it doesn't seem to be, you know, even though it's a European initiative, it does have some American involvement, I think. I saw some American companies' names and I was looking through the membership list, but I was kind of interested in 6G because Orange did a big webinar yesterday and they're showing off some of their research and development efforts as well earlier in the week. And it's quite apparent. Right, yeah. I mean, they had a They had a guy called Nicolas Demessieux on the call yesterday, who works for Orange Labs, which is their big R&D unit. Orange is quite interesting because he, I mean, this is a claim of theirs that would need to be verified, I suppose, but he was saying that they have a much bigger R&D presence than most other telcos. There's only a small number of operators actually around the world that spend a fair amount of money on R&D.
Okay.
AT&T's one, China, yep. China Telecom. And Orange is basically right up there. I mean, and I looked through their annual report. They spent about 700 million euros last year on R&D.
That's a lot, isn't it?
A lot.
When you consider they could not spend that and spend it on... Yeah. Sponsoring the French Open or something.
So Ericsson's overall budget each year, and it's an equipment maker, obviously, is for about $4.5 billion. So it's a big budget for an operator. But the thing that was really interesting to me was, you know, he was sort of explaining the rationale for Orange spending a lot on R&D at the moment and getting involved in things like 6G. And a lot of the stuff we've just been talking about, you know, the world's a really uncertain place at the moment. We've got geopolitical worries, we've got a pandemic, we've got global warming. There's a lot of risk. There's a lot of companies going around suing each other at the moment, you know, for over patents. And we see China being far more aggressive there. Now that Huawei and ZTE have got this decent position in 5G that they never had in 3G or 4G, all of a sudden they're starting to look to litigation. And, you know, we see these battles developing in Chinese courts, and they're trying to litigate in other parts of the world as well. So he was saying we need to have a presence in R&D, and we need to have our own sort of patent portfolio just for defensive reasons, you know, because when it comes to those clashes, you need to be able to show that you've got, you know, that you shouldn't be paying royalties and that you have standard essential patents. But also, you know, a lot of the stuff he was saying about uncertainty and, you know, the need to be more involved. And you hear this message from other operators as well. They don't want to be led by the manufacturers as much as they used to be, do they? They want to have a more kind of...
Ideally, you know, yeah.
influential role in the technology. I mean, Vodafone not that long ago was talking about its own efforts to develop IP and taking a bit of a stronger role in things like IT engineering. I mean, it just seems to me like 6G is becoming, with all that, as well as all these geopolitical ructions we're seeing at the moment, you know, and talk about, you know, Huawei being shut out of some parts of the world and maybe Western manufacturers being shut out of China. We're looking at a very, very messy 6G environment. You know, we're looking at lots of different initiatives springing up to do with particular regions wanting to have their own sort of, you know, say. Lots of operators getting involved that weren't before. I mean, one question I didn't ask him that I'd have been interested to is your aim to see that this guy from Orange, is your aim to have a much bigger role in 6G than you ever had in 5G? But it seems, you know, you look at the 5G standard and the big players that are involved in it. And, you know, I talk a lot about patent rankings, and I've written a few articles about them.
Yeah. They often disagree. And we chatted about it last week, didn't we?
But it's always the same names that come up. It's always the same six or seven big companies. Yeah. And it seems like with 6G, there's a lot more risk that, I mean, I don't know if it's risk, because in some ways it sounds good and healthy to have a lot more companies involved, and you sort of weaken the influence naturally of some of these players. But at the same time, it's going to make it very confusing and messy to reach a consensus on what's a global standard with all the geopolitical tension that's going on at the same time.
You know, and we don't even know, you know, we're not even that sure yet what the point of 5G is. I should point out another story.
This is the other thing.
I put up today. Although, you know, this is one of these weird things. I actually got the press release into my inbox on Wednesday, but it seems to have gone under everyone's radar. I've noticed. I think you guys are covering it today as well, which is this adaptive mobile story that says network slicing could be a complete fucking nightmare for security.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we don't... I actually downloaded their white paper, and you know, I it's above my pay grade. I just had to go, yeah, it looks like you know what you're talking about. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me because of the complexity. You've got everything getting virtualized. The way you're able to do network slicing is basically through virtualization, because it's not like you're physically getting a chainsaw and slicing up the network. And so you're creating all these separate, semi-independent bits, but that are still independent, and then you're plugging bits in all over the shop, all these virtual network functions. And it stands to reason, whenever you create this order of magnitude greater complexity, you're bound to create more vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting thing. I don't know why I didn't cover it earlier in the week. It's just an example of me just not looking at my inbox properly. And, you know, we got so many incoming emails. You know, I'm not having, certainly not having a go at the PR people who did it, because I'm not the only ones, but
I don't even remember seeing it, to be honest with you. But
no, but with something like that, you know, someone could do with going, look, this isn't just any old bullshit press release. This is actually quite a big deal.
But to your point about nobody really knows what 5G is going to, you know, before, apart from sort of better mobile broadband services, and we're still kind of hoping that it might do more than that, or the advocates are, it might have some kind of impact on business and enterprise stuff that we haven't quite seen. I think the other thing about 6G and the fact there's so many different people trying to get involved is everybody's got a slightly different idea about what 6G should be. You know, and the Orange guy set this out really well. He said there's sort of two broad camps. There's the ones that, there's the people that kind of see 6G in the kind of usual manner that you look at when you look at a new generation of technology, i.e. it's an improvement on what came before. You know, it's 10 times faster than 5G. It's 10 times lower latency. It's 10 times more capacity. And then you've kind of got the blue sky thinkers who are saying, well, hang on a minute, it should be about more than that. I mean, I remember talking to some guys from the University of Surrey a few months ago, and University of Surrey, by the way, is quite,
quite big right up there.
In comms. They're right up there. I talked to a few professors there. They have this really wacky, I mean, it sounds wacky to me, but they're deadly serious about it, and they're smart guys, but they have this sort of almost haptic sort of view of 6G, that it could be something where you have virtual reality worlds that allow you to kind of touch and taste and smell as well as see and hear, you know, the things that we kind of expect with 4G and 5G. And the guy from Orange was talking about maybe it's not just about speed and latency, but it's about things like energy efficiency for Orange. That's something they're kind of pushing quite heavily. And they want to do a public consultation actually in France, I think, to find out what people actually want with 6G. Now, it all sounds really good in a way, but if you've got all these different parties involved, you've got different regional bodies taking shape, and you've got operators wanting to have more of a say than they used to have, it sounds incredibly messy. Yeah. Trying to find a consensus for a global standard when you've got all this going on, as well as all the geopolitical turmoil we've seen.
And potential security nightmares. I mean, one thing I said at the end of the security piece is I hope they don't, you know, sacrifice security in the name of chasing 5G ROI, because that'll be self-defeating. You know, if you get a big hack of a network sliced 5G network, then trust in the whole technology is gonna fall off a cliff, isn't it?
Yeah,
completely. So I agree. And you know, and also we've spoken before about how it seems to have turned out that with generations of cellular technology, the odd number has been the first introduction of a new paradigm, and the even number has been sort of getting it right.
Yeah, but I'm sensed that 6G might not be that, because people have got these sort of wacky visions, and because there's so much else going on, I think it almost might. I mean, if it is just a getting it right of 5G, it's
what is there to get right though? Really, we don't even know what's so great about 5G yet,
But the other thing is that, what's 5G got wrong? I mean, most people are quite positive about 5G, aren't they? But most of the technical experts, when you talk to them, they're quite sort of upbeat about how it's all worked very well. I mean, the network slicing stuff is interesting, and that's a slightly different angle. But certainly when it comes to the stuff we've seen so far, improving broadband speeds and providing more capacity, which is something operators needed. Yeah, they all say they needed that extra boost that they got. It's, you know, not necessarily
about... Yeah, but I mean, I could say, like, off the top of my head, as a relative dilettante, because I'm just a journalist, not an engineer, I could say things like neither of us think millimeter waves particularly fucking useful at the moment.
But that's more of a spectrum thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but that's still spectrum you're using. Still part of that I'm saying that's something that can be improved on with 5G. Right now with 5G, millimeter wave, not that useful, regardless of what Verizon says.
But I'm not sure that's one thing ever going to be overcome with 6G. That's just
okay, but it's a
problem,
thing
that,
in an ideal world, if there was some quantum leap on the sort of ray tracing or whatever. There's, you know, the low latency. I don't know how well that's going. That's supposed to be the real super-duper.
The latency works well. So the thing that people misunderstand with latency on 5G is that the air interface itself is lower latency, but you don't get the low latency if you've got another bottleneck. So it's all very well having a better air interface, which brings those latency advantages. But if your data center is thousands of miles away, then, and you're trying to provide a low latency connection to somebody, then you're not going to get it. It's just, it's again, it's a physics problem. You need to be, this is what edge computing.
So you're right. So that's not so much a standard problem as just
that's
a,
more of an architecting.
Are you prepared to build enough?
Right way?
Yeah. Are you prepared enough to build enough?
I mean, maybe the stuff that 6G can do on network slicing. And I mean, I talked to somebody on the record from InterDigital about this months ago, who was saying that one vision of 6G is actually to be able to do network slices in a slightly more flexible way than you can with 5G. I mean, these security things that Adaptive Mobile's going on about weren't apparent then, but certainly being able to do.
And it could be nothing, but it's a wake-up call.
Yeah, but I just think, I mean, you're right about the odd standards, I think, do seem to have a bad rap. And I'm wondering if we look back on 5G in a few years' time and go, well, actually, that wasn't such a, you know, apart from the EMBB stuff, which is all very nice, but let's be honest, it's just basically an improvement on 4G.
Yeah.
Nothing else was really that great, because it's not, let's be honest, it's not come along at the best moment, has it, 5G? I mean, being plunged into the of a pandemic.
No. And well, the fact that 5G gives you coronavirus doesn't help, does it?
It gives you coronavirus. And I mean, I just, you know, even when we're past the pandemic, you know, hopefully later this year, next year, I don't know when that's going to be, but we've got several years of hard economic slog probably ahead of us, which aren't the conditions I think that people expected to be launching 5G into. So how much that constrains it. I mean, one concern for me perhaps is, does the investment, you know, it depends what kind of recovery we have, I guess, but does the investment go into some of these services that are being talked about with 5G? Does it delay companies' plans badly? You know, a lot of these companies are going out of business, airlines, retailers, you know, various other industries that telecom would want to be aiming its 5G services at are not in a very good position at the moment. And probably the last thing on their minds from a strategic perspective is, how do we make use of 5G? And I just wonder whether that really screws things up for them a little bit, you know.
Do you think 5G would have stopped that ship running aground in the Suez Canal? Because you hear, like, when people like Ericsson or whoever throw these 5G case studies at you, you always hear about smart ships and smart fucking...
Well, maybe that could be the 5G killer app, you know, stops your boat from crashing in the Suez Canal.
Maybe if it had all sensors in the hull, they would have gone, oh, hold on a sec, mate. You're listing.
You'd think they'd just notice that there's a bloody big edge of the canal there.
I mean, again, you know, I don't want to criticise a man till I've walked in his shoes, but, you know, hundreds of massive ships go through the Suez Canal every day, I think, certainly every week, and it's never happened before. So this lad's got to have dropped the ball big time, and maybe technology would have helped him, who knows. Anyway, we'd better move that one on, as I think we've done an hour already. And I'm going to introduce the last one. In fact, seeing as you're all distracted, this is quite a good good opportunity for me to have a monologue. So in the US, basically on a fairly regular basis now, at least once a year, they like to round up the CEOs of the big companies. So we've got Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, got Sundar Pichai, which I've remembered now, from Google. My dog's just kicking off as well, that's helpful. And we've got Jack Dorsey from Twitter. So their main beef is with social media, and the relevance for Google with social media is because it owns YouTube. And the reason politicians care is because they quite rightly think a hell of a lot of opinion is swayed by social media. You know, Trump was good, in inverted commas, at social media. In other words, he was prominent. And they're all worried that, you know, there was all this stuff which turned out to be nothing to do with Cambridge Analytica and the elections in 2016, which upset so much of the establishment. This is basically what started it. So we had elections in 2016, which was Brexit and Trump, both of which were anti-establishment outcomes. And so the establishment obviously didn't take this shit lying down. They go, there's got to be some foul play. And they clutched at straws. They came up with Cambridge Analytica, and all that really was them data mining Facebook to allow for politically targeted advertising. But politically targeted advertising happens all the time anyway, and no one bats an eyelid. So that was a complete storm in a teacup. But that hasn't stopped politicians obsessing about it. And there's stuff, you know, I'm going to get onto Section 230 in a bit, but there's just these sort of set-piece grillings they get from senators or representatives. They're just such bullshit. It's such grandstanding by the politicians that the CEOs genuinely look bored. There was one bit, I haven't actually watched the footage, but there was one bit where there were the politicians trying to act all tough and ask Jack Dorsey a question. He always looks the most bored. I think, you know, I think he's got a resting bored face to start with.
Well, that beard doesn't help.
Yeah, he always looks a bit stoned, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Which he may well be. And good luck to you, Jack, if you are. Why not? Yeah. We're having a beer. It's legal in half the states, isn't it? So it is. Why not? I mean, how rock and roll would that be really, if he just lit up a great big fat spliff before getting grilled by the US House of Representatives? If he was actually doing it, he's going, yeah, whatever, man. Why don't you just chill out? And apparently they tried to get all tough by saying yes or no answers only. So, of course, you know, they ask questions like, you know, do you hold yourself responsible for all those nutters steaming the Capitol building at the start of the year? And they'll equivocate and go, well, you know, there's obviously we don't condone that kind of shit, but, you know, it's not our fault if some nutters want to be nutters. Nutters going to nut, sort of thing. And they go, yes or no answer. And what they're trying to do is a bit what, you know, what like a bully boy journalist might do, like Jeremy Paxman or Andrew Neil, and just try and rhetorically talk them into a corner so they get their little gotcha moment. They go, ha, you admitted it's all your fault. And these guys weren't born yesterday. They are press trained to hell. They were prepared for weeks. They're really smart guys. And the funny thing is Jack Dorsey actually tweeted a... you know, you can do little questionnaires, little surveys on Twitter. And he just tweeted question mark and then it was just yes or no. So he was trolling these fuckers on Twitter while they were giving him a hard time. It's all just such a farce. But, you know, but the serious stuff behind it is my pet topic of social media censorship. And I wrote a story earlier on this week where Mark Zuckerberg published his testimony. You know, they always have set testimony at the start before they get this Q&A grilling. And he spoke about Section 230. And just to remind everyone, Section 230 is the bit of law that basically says that websites are not responsible, not legally responsible for what third parties put on. So that basically applies to all social media, because social media by definition is all about third parties. But it even gives us some protection. I mean, you don't have your comment section up and running, but we do. And presumably if someone put a comment on, maybe someone who'd already been approved and before we had a chance to take it down, put up something really out of order or even illegal, we should still be offered some protection. It's not us that's saying it. But then, you know, if, for example, the government went, Scott, you can't be having that shit on telecoms.com, it's illegal, and then I didn't take it down, then I would be liable, or we would collectively be liable. And so Section 230 kind of protects them from that. And you need it. The internet wouldn't function without Section 230. You wouldn't be able to have any third-party participation in any part of the internet without Section 230. So people calling for its outright appeal are just deluded. But it does also effectively make a distinction between publishers and platforms. So if I put something up under my byline and it's illegal, you know, I'm calling for the murder of a named individual, then I've got to be to blame and an informer's got to be to blame. Whereas if some rando says that on Twitter, Jack Dorsey's not to blame because he's not the publisher. But as they act in a more and more editorial capacity, i.e. they say certain things cannot appear on our platform full stop, regardless of the law, we've just decided. For example, they take a really hard line on anything to do with trans people. You can't dead name people. You've got to refer to the correct pronoun and all that sort of thing. You know, then they're entering into sort of more cultural, not legal things, but cultural things. And so it could reasonably be argued that they're then acting in an editorial capacity and therefore these protections should no longer apply to them. And Zuckerberg said, look, we think there should be reform of Section 230. Why don't you make it so that you only get Section 230 protections if you put loads of processes in place to make sure that illegal shit gets taken down nice and quickly? And on first reading, you sort of think, yeah, all right, Zuck, yeah, fair enough. That's a good point. But then you realise that those processes are probably incredibly expensive. So what he's really doing, and this is what companies do all the time.
Our rivals.
Yeah, exactly. They're saying if it's going to be regulation, make it really expensive regulation that we can afford and that smaller rivals can't. So you know that's a sort of undercurrent of what's going on,
which I wonder, Scott, you've written about this and I've written about it a bit as well, but the whole Parler issue, you know, when Parler was taken off AWS servers because it was you know, some of the commentary on it was well, that was the AWS argument, wasn't it? Some of the commentary was too spicy, I suppose. But is it harder for a company like that, which is a relatively small business compared with Twitter, say, even though it's sort of seen as the alternative to Twitter for the hard right, isn't it? Is the cliched sort of description of it in parts of America. But it sounds to me like if you did have a regulation along those lines, it would make it much harder for anybody, possibly Parler, but certainly anybody else coming along trying to get themselves going in the first place wouldn't stand a chance. This is the stupid thing, is that, you know, we talk about net neutrality as a way of leveling the playing field to some extent in the internet, you know, and making it easier for smaller firms to compete and ensure they don't get kind of blocked out by and discriminated against by network operators. And then you've got this sort of thing going on, which is far bigger and far more important, I think, you know, that these firms are just so, you know, overbearing at the moment. And even the suggestion that something like that might happen is clearly a way of shutting out rivals. It's no different from Facebook going around mopping up tiny players that seemed irrelevant at the time, like Instagram and WhatsApp, that, you know, and it's quite apparent now why it was doing
that. They weren't tiny at the time, just to be slightly...
They weren't that tiny, but nobody, I don't think regulators had an inkling of what was going on, did they?
Now they've got this remorse going, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we know that we've got colleagues who disagree with my position on Parler and AWS, but I'll defend my position once more with some new information that's come out. So what I'm saying is people who think it's all right for AWS to cut off Parler, going, well, they got their terms and conditions, Parler broke them, so fuck them. You know, and then you get this cliche of like, oh, they're a private company, they can do what they want. But when those terms and conditions seem to be enforced selectively, and I believe Twitter has some kind of relationship with AWS, I think Facebook is entirely on its own infrastructure, but I believe Twitter has some kind of relationship with AWS. Now, and they don't get those same rules applied equally to them. That's where I call foul. And I was watching a podcast where I heard about a new bit of evidence. Apparently Parler, way back in November last year, November, December, was sharing posts with the FBI going, look, these people are saying, let's march on the Capitol and be violent. They're saying, so they were trying to be good boys and going, look, this is happening on our platform. We're not happy about it. We want to flag it up to you. They were trying to be good citizens. Up. You what? Parler was flagging it up. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So AWS's claim that Parler should have been kicked off because it wasn't doing enough is just bollocks.
Yeah,
there's just growing evidence, and this is all stuff being submitted because obviously there'll have been some massive inquiry into how that thing on the 6th of January could have happened, and how complicit social media was in it. This is a lot of the grilling they were getting yesterday. Yeah. But you know, I think it's becoming increasingly obvious that Parler not only was most of the shit planned on Facebook anyway. If it was planned on social media at all, I think disproportionately it was on Facebook. But Parler was doing its best to prevent this stuff happening and to flag it up to the authorities when it was happening. So I think it's just further evidence that I can't prove it, but it's very easy for me to believe it's just a stitch up of these big companies ensuring that smaller rivals can't exist, and Zuckerberg's call for onerous regulation is just part of that.
Yeah, totally.
So yes, I mean we'll see where it goes. You know, it's,
but they
it's
do really... have.
Go on.
The weird thing is that they you know, the issue of sort of extremism on social media is very inconsistent, isn't it? I mean, it's you know, if you look at Twitter, don't they? Doesn't one of the
Ayatollah Iranian
mullahs
who calls for the destruction of Israel? Yeah, so he can call for the destruction of Israel, but someone sort of refers to someone by the wrong pronoun and they're kicked off.
It's just really
exactly.
Odd. exactly. And this is where you sense that their own kind of political leanings come to bear here in terms of what they decide is acceptable and what yes. isn't. It's not something that's applied equally across the board.
Yeah, and all this serves to illustrate is why censorship's dodgy. You get people increasingly of the sort of leftist persuasion who are quite pro-censorship because they don't want badness on the internet. You know, Ofcom, I wrote a story this week, Ofcom is trying to lower the bar for what hate speech is and coming up with these really tenuous things. Yeah. It's got some new designation called negative incidents or some shit like that, which includes things like perceived fake news and someone sending you an unsolicited friend request. I mean,
negative influence and hate. Yeah, I mean, they're almost like expression. They are expressions you could find in the pages of an Orwell novel, aren't they? They really are.
I know it's hackneyed, but let me find it because it's just ridiculous. I even put the chart up. You should look up the story, Ian. It's got the chart. And I said yes, as if it wasn't broad and vague enough, Ofcom tells us a whopping 70% of respondents, so they did a survey of people who use, this is specifically video sharing platforms, by the way. So this isn't social media, this is YouTube and stuff. Ofcom tells us a whopping 70% of respondents said that they have been exposed to potentially harmful experiences. That's the key word. So it wasn't that's the Orwellian thing. Here's a full list of those experiences. Fake news, 49%. Offensive language, 45%. Unwelcome friend/follow requests or messages, 40%. Trolling, deceptive images, and so on. All, you know.
I mean, they're so nebulous, some of these things, aren't they?
Yeah, and then just hate. This multi-purpose word for anything you don't like. Yeah. But you can hate horrid people, of course. So, everyone's trying to censor more. And, you know, the one thing I'll say, perhaps in conclusion, as we've run over, the thing about censorship is who decides. Okay, we can all agree some degree of censorship is required. Certainly, it's good that there are laws that say, I can't write a story going, everyone go and find Ian Morris and kill him.
Yeah.
There has to be protections for you. So I'm not a free speech absolutist. That kind of speech, specifically inciting targeted violence, is bad. Speech inciting violence against groups, I would say, is bad. You know, attack this race or attack this religion or attack this nationality or sexual preference or whatever. That's bad. But it's increasingly sort of metastasizing into saying anything bad about anyone. And that's where hate speech comes up. And the thing is, someone has to decide. The thing I hate most about censorship is I think I can decide. If I see something on social media, if you see something I don't like, in the pub, I think you're talking shit, I'll say, Ian, you're talking shit.
Yeah.
I don't need to be protected from it.
Yeah.
If someone else decides, no, Scott, you can't hear the stuff Ian's saying, it's too harmful, then, you know, I'm a grown-up.
It's nanny-statism, isn't it?
It's nanny-statism, and who decides? Ultimately, a human being's got to decide. We're all flawed. We're all subjective. Yeah. We've all got our own agendas.
It's what parents do to their kids, but we don't need the state doing it to us.
Well, quite. And even, you know, we've both got kids at similar ages. You know, when they start become late teenagers, then we stop protecting them and we start saying, look, when you see this kind of shit, just watch out. But obviously, we're part of our job as parents is to train them to be autonomous, self-sufficient adults who are able to make, you know, good decisions for themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that analogy applies even further in that case. So that's what's going on. I don't know why these politicians, I mean, I do know why. They're calling for this censorship because they want the other team censored. It's nothing more sophisticated than that. You know, we had those absurd Democrats calling for Fox News calling for AT&T and stuff to not run Fox News because it's horrid.
Yeah.
And I wish totally everyone would just pack it in. There. You what?
It's totally partisan over in the States. You know, everything's one thing or the other.
It is. I mean, actually, just one final line to draw under all this geopolitical stuff. There was a sort of summit between the US and China in Alaska, which I suppose is considered, while it's US territory, it's sort of on the way to China, isn't it?
if you want to go that way.
On the way to Manchuria or something. And the Americans started off with this grandstanding going, look, we just want to say that we think you're really out of order with Xinjiang and Hong Kong and all this shit and just fucking sort it out. And China just went, well, hold on a sec.
you've got all this stuff going on. You've got, you know, and they're basically throwing the culture wars back in America's faces. You've got all this racism going on in the States because America's always is sort of obsessed with race once more right now. And I'm not saying they shouldn't, but, you know, there's another thing. There's a film I keep hearing about called The Mauritian, which is about this guy who got locked up in Guantanamo Bay for 20 years. He didn't even do anything. So we've got this problem, you know, and this comes back to the chip thing and the 6G thing and this whole big geopolitical tussle of, you know, how much of a leg does America have to stand on preaching to China morally when it's not exactly squeaky clean itself? Yeah. So it's all really tricky. And, you know, we have a go at them for not having a free press. But then if these senators are going to come out with it, or these representatives are going to come out of this stuff, then they're arguing against a free press as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're going to morally preach, you better make sure. You what?
You'd think people would realise this, but it does make you question the intelligence, doesn't it, really, sometimes, I think.
I don't think they lack intelligence. I think they're just cynical. And it's just one rule for me, another for thee, and it's all very boring. But anyway, we better wrap it up there. So, yes, thank you very much for listening, and make sure you join us for the next one.